Hello and welcome to a podcast from the EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference. This podcast is sponsored by Real Networks.
Today we're joined by Dr. V.S. Ramachandran. Dr. Ramachandran is director of the Center for Brain and Cognition and professor at the University of California, San Diego. Dr. Ramachandran, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So maybe I can get us started by stepping back a bit. We're here in Orlando at a conference probing the intersection of education and technology, but I'm wondering if we could talk briefly about your work with phantom limbs and to what degree, if at all, this work might challenge us to pause before leaping to or, well, waiting on technology as a solution for many of the teaching and learning challenges that we're all looking to address. Any thoughts on that front?
Yeah, let me step back even further and say that in the old days, people used to think science and technology were one universe, and the humanities were a different universe, including art, literature, poetry, psychology, including psychology. Mm. But now, it was C.P. Snow, the Englishman who first made this distinction, that there are two parallel universes, essentially, and never the twain shall meet. Science on the one hand, humanities on the other hand. Now that's been changing in the last 10, 15 years. There's talk about neuroeconomics, neurotheology, neuroaesthetics, all sorts of neuro this and neuro that. Mm-hmm. Some of this is just promissory notes, but some of them I think are genuinely motivated and they're going to be important in the future. So what I'm arguing is that the brain, understanding the brain is going to be the bridge between the two cultures, between humanities on the one hand and science on the other hand. Now, with regard to the phantom limb work, we found two things. One is the brain is much more plastic, much more malleable than anyone ever imagined. If you amputate an arm, you find that there's a complete reorganization of sensory maps in the brain in a very short period, in a period of weeks. This shows that it provides what a mathematician would call an existence proof, that the connections are not fixed early in infancy. Even the basic connection can be changed with relatively simple procedures. The same thing we've seen in patients with paralyzed phantoms, which are excruciatingly painful, and indeed people who have paralysis from stroke. If you put a mirror on the table, this is very simple virtual reality, and look at the reflection of the normal hand in the mirror so that you're looking, you get the illusion that you're looking at the paralyzed arm or the phantom limb. And then if you move the normal arm so you get the illusion that the paralyzed arm is moving or the phantom is moving, this seems to alleviate the pain in the phantom or actually help accelerate recovery from paralysis in the paralyzed arm. So this is radical. You're using visual input to go and mobilize a paralyzed arm by reviving some dormant circuits there. Even more remarkable is the fact that you can exploit a group of neurons called mirror neurons, but why don't we return to that topic? Because it's something which we're currently working on, we're excited about. One take-home message from all this is there's a tremendous amount of interaction between different brain structures. I mean, the old view of the brain is there are separate specialized modules, which are each one of them specialized for a different function, and they don't interact very much. So there's modularity, and they're hardwired in infancy. So they're hardwired, they don't interact. Now, brain disease is thought to result from, you know, you punch out a module and that's it. Now, what we're arguing is a complete revision of that view of the brain, that in fact, all these so-called modules interact with each other to a significant extent and interact with the environment and can be altered by changing the visual environment, so much so that you really should think of the different brain areas as being in a state of dynamic equilibrium with each other and with the external world. And often neurological syndromes arise from shifts in equilibria rather than just punching out a module. If so, you can shift the equilibrium back to normal using relatively simple procedures like a mirror. So that's the take-home message. And this malleability, of course, may be true for many brain functions and may have a message for education.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, one quick follow-up on that. Virtual technology right now, virtual worlds are fairly primitive. And if the quality of the virtual visualization of an arm, for instance, is not the same fidelity of that with it you can get in a mirror, for instance, could the brain not quite make those same connections that you can achieve by a simple mirror?
Well, eventually it might be possible to achieve the same goal, but when you use reality, well, you use virtual reality, to put it crudely. I mean, right now this is cheap, effective, and lots of places use it. The advantage with virtual reality is, let's say your both arms paralyzed, which happens, or you've got both arms amputated, which happens. Right. You cannot use the mirror procedure. Right. Then you have to use the reality. But at this stage in the game, when you're trying to understand the basic principles of recovery and organization, the mirror is the way to go.
And the highest fidelity.
The only limitation is the velocity of light reflected from the mirror.
Last year we heard from Bruce Schneier, a security expert who's begun looking into economics and psychology as a means to understand and improve cybersecurity. A couple of years ago, Ray Kurzweil stopped by for a discussion, and while his talk was focused heavily on technology, it left me wondering if he wasn't a wannabe cognitive scientist. Now, here we are today with a bona fide cognitive scientist, and I can't help but wonder if you have any general commentary about the future, both the exciting and scary topics that we'll be forced to confront over the next few decades.
Well, I'm familiar with some of Ray's ideas, and I think he's a visionary and a futurologist and has some very interesting ideas. But sometimes he goes too far, as when he says there's a specific date. But I'm sure he's being facetious when he says that. But in terms of the dangers, in terms of the promise for the future, as I said earlier, understanding the brain is critical to understanding human nature. So everything like terrorism, war, all the bad things or all the good things, falling in love and all that, arise ultimately from these 100 billion neurons interacting with this. There's a massive jelly in your head that produces terrorism, that produces war, that produces fanatical religion, and all of that. So without understanding the brain, you can never hope to change those things. And then there's a question of whether you would want to change them. That's a separate question. Right? So the technology will develop to the point where you can start making these changes, and then it becomes a complete question of human values. You can't argue from is to ought, as the famous saying goes. Then it becomes the question of, do you all want to... I mean, look at the end state of this. Already we've got the iPhone. You've got everything at your fingertips. The time will come, then you get up in the morning, there's a panel and everything at your fingertips. You punch this, you get your food delivered. And even further you go, it becomes like X-Men. And you have, and the philosophers talk about a brain in the vat, where it's nourished and you simulate the external world. If you could do that, would you do it? And this becomes an ethical dilemma. Right. You could say it's not going to happen anytime soon, but an approximation to that is already happening. Okay, but the World Wide Web, things are at your surfing, things are at your fingertips. So the extreme case of this may happen a few thousand years from now, a few hundred years from now. What do you do then? It becomes an ethical choice. Right? On the other hand, on the positive side, you cannot understand things like terrorism, what prompts people to engage in this, or even war, or dare I say, imperialism, colonialism, all of these things, all these isms, racism. If you understand the brain, you're going to be able to eliminate all of these evils.
Let's talk a bit more about this rapidly evolving intersection of science and technology. Assuming amazing advances in fMRI, genetic profiling, and biochemical and neurochemical monitoring, do you think we'll ever see some cradle-to-grave prescriptive learning plan that is tailored in real time to individual characters, characteristics, innate abilities, individual goals, and learning styles?
Well, again, there are two questions that are being confounded. One is a question of values. What do you want out of life? What do you want for people? The other is the technology. How far is it going to go? And how much can you manipulate the brain? And how important is technology for understanding the brain? And I think everybody would agree technology drives science to a significant extent. Mm-hmm. Just think of the microscope. Mm-hmm. You know, the discovery of the microscope, two lenses, opened a whole universe. I mean, you know, of microbes and microbiology and cells, and biology was born when the microscope was invented, and later things like X-ray crystallography. Similarly, the telescope. When Galileo looked through the telescope for the first time, we understood man's place in the cosmos. But what's equally important is the eye behind the instrument, whether it's fMR, diffusion tensor imaging, whatever brain imaging technique you're using, or a telescope, or a microscope, the eye behind it is equally important. People knew about the telescope long before Galileo. It was used as a toy for spying on neighbors, okay, at a distance. It was Galileo who first said, let me just tilt it and look at the sky. Okay, so the instrument in itself is going to be useless unless there's a brain behind it interpreting and asking the right questions. So that would be my take on it. But the other question is, if you do understand the brain using all this technology, if you can then manipulate the brain using technology, what would you want to manipulate? Obviously, brain disorders you want to correct. But if you can do brain enhancement, in what direction do you want to enhance it? Do you want to enhance creativity? Do you want to enhance linear thinking? Do you want to enhance diversity? Or do you want all people to be very similar to each other? All of these are ethical questions which science has no bearing on. Right. It only says it's possible, like science can perform an abortion very easily. Mm-hmm. But whether you want it or not becomes an ethical dilemma.
Do you have any sense for whether there will be anything to glean from the rate at which electronics are being used in the body? I'm thinking of some tipping point or signal that suggests that something has or is about to fundamentally change our relationship with electronics, or some radical advance in nanotechnology or the like. Is there some technology that you're anxiously waiting for and hoping that will introduce some phenomenal new experience?
Well, if I could predict it, I'd go out there and do it right now. That's a problem with making prophecies. But I think the kinds of technology with Larry Smarr, one of my colleagues at UCSD, was talking about, perfection of some of the existing technology, improving the resolution of fMRI, for example, is going to prove to be very valuable. But speaking of technology and brain, you also have to be very careful with inventing a new toy and letting people use it. The experiments should be concept-driven, not by technology. It shouldn't be driven by technology. It should be driven by concept. And 98% of fMRI studies are technology-driven, or methodology-driven, I should say. And, for example, you go to a meeting. About a year ago, I went to Society for Neuroscience meeting, took my students there, and looked at a picture. You know, you go to the poster after poster after poster after poster. Poster scientists present their recent work. And you see a lateral picture of the brain, a sideways view of the brain, and there's a bunch of functions like repetition blindness, working memory, Stroop interference. There are about a dozen of these functions. And then there are about four or five places in the brain where you see red spots lighting up. And every poster is different combinations of red spots, different combinations of these tasks. And there are hundreds of posters. And the next year you go, it's the same list, same tasks, okay, randomly shuffled, and the dots appear in new locations, sometimes not even in new locations, same location. It takes the whole romantic spirit out of science. It's as though you got this new technology, gee whiz, let's see what lights up. Right. So technology can be liberating, can give you a new approach to solving scientific problems. It can also be limiting if you're not careful.
There are a range of interesting activities these days, but perhaps you can close us out with some thoughts on recent research that really piques your interest and leaves you wanting for more. What's really getting your juices flowing these days?
Well, let's see. We tend to work on many things in parallel. I'm interested in autism. We're interested in a group of neurons in the brain that have been called mirror neurons. Mm-hmm. Normally, these neurons fire when you are touched. I touch your finger, the touch neurons in your brain fire. This has been known for years. Mm-hmm. Just behind your somatosensory cortex is a region that gets touch sensations from your body. Astonishingly, a group of these neurons will fire even when you watch me being touched. Okay, so it's as though it's breaking the barrier between you and me, so you can call them empathy neurons or Gandhi neurons, because mirror neurons also exist for pain. Now, I find this very intriguing, and we recently did an experiment, to give you an example, where a patient with an amputated arm looks at a person being touched. What happens is that the patient then feels the touch sensations in his phantom arm, even though somebody else is being touched, breaking down the barrier between self and other people, not in some abstract metaphorical sense, but quite literally dissolving the skin between you and me, okay? And this is obvious clinical implications as well. So that's one of the areas of interest. So basically, we're interested in human cognition, what makes humans special, how the brain evolved, and how some of the higher functions of the brain are mediated by neural activity in different parts of the brain. Okay, yes. Now, the experiments with mirrors and phantom limbs show that there is tremendous amount of interaction between different brain regions, much more so than people suspected, and tremendous amount of malleability of the brain, connections in the brain. Mm-hmm. This is obvious relevance to education. The experiments with mirror neurons show that not only do barriers between modules break down, but barriers between people, between your brain and my brain, can be eliminated under appropriate circumstances. More recently, people have found, McCabe and Halligan and others and Pat Wall, that if you put a mirror and you put a real arm on one side of the mirror and you have, say, some pain or injury in one side, and you put a mirror and you put the normal side on the other side of the mirror and you move the normal hand so it looks like the hand with the injury is moving, you actually register temperature changes in the hidden hand, okay? Just as a result of the visual input kicking in, produces temperature changes in the body. Now, this has been an extraordinary example of mind-body interaction. You're getting visual input going all the way back to the skin and affecting the constriction of blood vessels and production of sweat in the skin.
Wow.
So this is an example of dissolving the barrier between mind and the body. Mirror neurons dissolve the barrier between one person and another person's brain. And example of the mirror and phantom limbs shows modules between within the brain, modules of vision and modules of somatosensory interact to a tremendous extent. This type of dynamic interaction is going to be very much part of future research, both in our lab and other labs.
You know, I remember back to some undergraduate psychology courses I've taken in the past, and I think of metacognition and how you get multimodal sensory experiences to increase your ability to retrieve thoughts. Does it have any bearing on that front?
Well, indirectly, because you're saying that there's a great deal more interaction between different modules and between the module and the skin, mm-hmm. brain and body, mm-hmm. and between people. Mm-hmm. So this is surely going to change your view of the dynamics of brain function. So indirectly, it's going to influence your thinking about specific aspects of brain function.
Social learning, perhaps?
Perhaps,
yeah.
Yes.
Interesting.
I mean, for example, we have suggested that mirror neuron deficiency is one of the causes of autism. We don't know this for sure, mm-hmm. but it might contribute to autism. If so, can you enhance the activity of mirror neurons by simply watching other people imitate each other?
Yeah.
Okay. And if so, would that be a way of treating autism? Yeah. We haven't explored this yet, but we're planning to.
Well, it looks like we've got time for one more question. Let's talk about an area that I believe you've developed some affinity for, art. These days, when I think of art, my mind seems to gravitate less towards individual artists and more towards folks like yourself, Steven Pinker, Howard Gardner, Michael Albert, Noam Chomsky, and others. I'm not sure why exactly that is, but I wondered if you could share any general commentary on the future of art, our education, and the intersection of art and technology.
Sure. I think several points here. One is what I call the spillover effect. If you make people creative in one dimension through practice, for example. Mm-hmm. First of all, some of it is genetic, I'm sure, but I'm sure it can be enhanced through practice. So in an individual brain, you make him creative by giving him lots of jokes. I think jokes involve unusual juxtaposition of ideas, mm-hmm. and that's the basis of art, mm-hmm. any type of artistic endeavor. So that might spill over into visual art, into music, into poetry, into literature. Likewise, teaching somebody poetry can make him more creative in science. Now, this has never been tested empirically, but I strongly suspect that it's true. So that's one brief answer to your question about enhancing creativity. Now, let's talk about art, visual art. Mm-hmm. Now, the word art is loaded. I mean, you can take a pig, put it in formaldehyde, put a gold crown on it, and call it art. Mm-hmm. Now, that's why I stay away from the word art.
Right.
In the past, I've just used art and aesthetics synonymously, but now I don't use the word art.
Okay.
I became interested in aesthetics, which I think is cross-cultural, by and large.
Right.
So there may be some genetic mechanisms involved in aesthetics. And there are two questions. Why did art evolve, okay, in human beings, given its wide prevalence? And another question is, are there some fundamental laws of art, mm-hmm. universal principles of art,
mm-hmm.
Even though despite the staggering variety, diversity of artistic styles, could there be some common principles that cut across cultural boundaries? My answer is yes. There are some fairly elementary laws like grouping, for example, mm-hmm. which are aesthetically pleasing. Symmetry is aesthetically pleasing. And these are all principles of aesthetics, and we have about 8 or 9 principles of aesthetics. And the question is, why did these principles evolve? Do they have a function? You know. And secondly, for example, aesthetics may be involved in detecting prey, predator, mm-hmm. or mate, because living things usually are symmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
Moving living things especially, which are important to you, important for the organism. So some of these, and grouping may be important for detecting camouflaged objects.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these laws have functions. So one of the goals of our research is to clearly specify what the law is, the logic,
mm-hmm.
like grouping
mm-hmm.
or peak shift,
mm-hmm.
and then ask, what is its evolutionary function, if any? And third, what is a neural instantiation? So it's a triangle, and all three of these need to be in place for each of these laws I'm talking about.
Right.
Now, regarding the question of culture, obviously what I'm talking about is just the principles that cut across cultures.
Mm-hmm.
But that may be only 10%. Mm-hmm. But as a scientist, that's what I'm interested in.
Right.
Maybe 90% of art and the variety of, obviously there's so many varieties of art, culture must play a tremendous role.
Mm-hmm.
But as a scientist, I'm interested in the universal laws of aesthetics.
Right.
Now, the other question is, why did art evolve? And there I would say, you can go back 50,000 years, 100,000 years, and there are crude, well, I shouldn't say crude, very beautiful representations of bison and hunting scenes. And I would say what happened at that time was maybe people had limited ability to engage in imagery. Right, because our brains have evolved now to the point of where you can do virtual reality in your head. Mm. Maybe at that time it's a time of transition, and to enact a bison hunt, it was useful to create a virtual reality environment. So what I'm arguing is art was nature's first virtual reality, the brain's first attempt to create virtual reality. So the bison hunts are a way of rehearsing bison hunts in your mind before you actually go and spear a bison. And that's how it may have got started. Of course, now it serves other purposes, just aesthetic enjoyment, for example, and cross-cultural exchange of ideas, or within a culture, cohesiveness between different individuals, communication of art, for example. But originally, it may have evolved as virtual reality.
Dr. Ramachandran, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. Do you have any closing thoughts?
Well, in terms of closing thoughts, I would say there's nothing more exciting now than for a young person to start studying neuroscience, doing research in the brain, partly because we've got all these new toys, which are going to be useful, partly because it's very early days yet, and that's when science is most fun.
Right.
Like it was like, it's like 19th century physics, where people were just tinkering.
Right.
You know, Faraday just took a coil and waved a magnet and discovered the laws of electromagnetic induction, linking two completely unrelated domains, electricity and magnetism, which until then people thought were not related. He just moved a magnet in a coil and showed that they were related.
Mm-hmm.
Or Newton's prism experiment, or Galileo dropping a cannonball and a pea from a tower and showing them hit the ground at the same side. So that was a time when physics was extremely exciting, chemistry was exciting, and when it becomes crowded a field, it becomes less exciting. But now, neuroscience is where it's at.
Well, thanks again, and enjoy the rest of your stay in Orlando.
Thank you.
This EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference podcast is sponsored by Real Networks. Real Networks enables digital delivery of distance learning coursework, athletic events, and more to students anywhere. Information at realnetworks.com.